I think is happening, Andy, is you've interviewed Rick Roll, and you know his thing about, you know, for the past 50 years, the average allocation to gold in the portfolios globally has been around 2%, but in recent years, it's only been 0.5%. So a reversion to mean would quadruple the investment demand for gold, right? You know, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. You know, the world has changed. There's Bitcoin now in the world where there wasn't before. And, you know, I don't think of Bitcoin and gold as interchangeable, but the average financial cat on Wall Street might. I don't know. What I'm saying is, I don't assume that the world has to go back to the way it was 50 years ago. But let's just say it goes back halfway.
Lobo Tigra, independent speculator. Good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
Happy to be back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for coming up on board. First of all, as mentioned off camera, we had a great run in gold, as well as the miner, the gold stocks, really from January, or you can even think really since maybe even November, December of last year, but moving towards to maybe mid part or really the last part of the spring. As well as the gold price has really consolidated here for the 8 to 10 weeks, it seems like. What are your thoughts? Does this have more room to run? And give me your thoughts on that.
Well, that's a lot of threads to pull on there. Quick answer is, yes, I do think it has more room to run. And this is interesting because I'm the guy that, you know, everybody moves away from me on the Group W bench when I point out that a hockey stick type performance makes it prudent to, you know, brace for some level of correction. And, you know, other things being equal, I would probably be in that camp now for gold. I mean, 3,500, if you adjust for CPI, actually matches the 1980 peak. That, so you could say that, of course, CPI, I know, but using that stat, you could say that that was a real all-time high in gold and it bounced off it. That seems significant. And your audience and mine, you know, that we may not put a lot of weight on the CPI, but the big players out there and their computers and their models, they do, right? So it's not insignificant. And, you know, normally, I you know, like I said, I would probably be in the caution camp. You know, I wouldn't be selling everything. You know, I'm always going to be saving in gold. Bullion savings is a completely different question from speculating on price movements. And for that, I use the stocks, not the bullion. But I am bullish. And the reason why, well, there's a number of reasons, but the big one is that this business of the so-called weaponization of the dollar and the central banks around the world piling into gold, and that's not done. There's just a survey out today. I saw the headline today, and it wasn't just World Gold Council. It was somebody else surveying monetary authorities around the world, and something like 40% of them say they're going to be accumulating more gold, or they expect to be accumulating more gold going forward. So this is a really, really big deal. And I think of it as a paradigm shift. This is a one-way change. Nobody's going back, certainly not BRICS countries, are going back to saying, you know what, it's perfectly fine to have our economic life's blood controlled by Washington and New York. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, at the same time, you've got Basel III, which includes gold as a tier one asset. So you can put it on your books, which changes the incentive structure for your average central banker out there. You know, it just seems to me the writing is on the wall. Now let me be careful here on the side. I'm not saying, therefore, central banks are going to send it to $10,000 an ounce or anything crazy like that. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that there is a new buyer, a durable buyer. There's a bid under gold that just wasn't there before. And so in previous years, when we've seen things like, well, heck, as you and I are speaking, the White House is doing victory laps of peace breaking out. And that has set gold back, or it did yesterday. It's back up again today. You know, if the worst that something like that, you know, peace means you don't need a safe haven metal anymore. Like if it was the war that drove gold up, it wasn't. It went to 3,500 before the war, before the war escalated. But it, you know, if it was peace breaking out, you would think that would be the end. We'd, you know, it'd be all down. But instead, it just fluctuates, and the next day it's back up again. Or, you know, if we had had this conversation a year ago or 2 years ago, we'd be all, the question would be framed in terms of what is the Fed going to do, right? You know, right. Cut interest rates, you know, what's that going to do to gold? And now we almost couldn't care less. We have these Fed meetings come and go, has no impact because there's this really deep pocketed buyer out there. And I think that's something that the average gold bug should look at and think about. Like the game has changed. Sometimes things are different. And on top of that, I think this I can't prove. Like the central bank thing, that's, you know, even the other side admits that. But the other thing that I can't prove yet, I think is happening, Andy, is you've interviewed Rick Roll and you know his thing about, you know, for the past 50 years, the average allocation to gold in the portfolios globally has been around 2%, but in recent years, it's only been 0.5%. So a reversion to mean would quadruple the investment demand for gold, right? You know, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. You know, the world has changed. There's Bitcoin now in the world where there wasn't before. And, you know, I don't think of Bitcoin and gold as interchangeable, but the average financial cat on Wall Street might. I don't know. What I'm saying is I don't assume that the world has to go back to the way it was 50 years ago. But let's just say it goes back halfway there, right? In the scary world that we're in, that people start saying, you know what, a little bit of gold is a good idea to hedge my portfolio. Let's just say it goes to 1%. You know, this isn't, you know, crazy land, everybody, you know, stacking gold to the rafters or anything like that. Just a 1% portfolio allocation to gold globally would double investment demand. And what I'm saying is I think we see signs, not proof, soft data, if you will, of this happening. I see, you know, like normal people in, you know, that I meet in my life starting to talk about gold and silver. I mean, it's actually getting mentioned. You see the talking heads on financial media, you know, a couple of years ago, if they asked somebody what they were doing in their portfolio and they said, oh, we got a bit of gold in there as a hedge, they'd kind of laugh and say, haha, you know, and then it became more of a drumbeat, you know, oh, I've got gold in there. And they'd be, oh, really? Tell me about that. And now it's gotten to the point where the talking heads are saying, what are you doing with your portfolio? Do you have any gold in it as a hedge? Right? The conversation has really changed, which in Wall Street parlance indicates a crowded trade. And this is part of the buzz now that gold is a crowded trade. And people view this as a bearish argument. Oh, it's the crowded trade. It's got to go down. Well, it's crowded on Wall Street where people pay attention to momentum. And how can you not notice something breaking out to an all-time high? Right. So, but that doesn't mean that the average retail person out there is long. And so this is part B of my answer. Sorry to be long-winded, but I'm wrapping up here. You know, I was there in the 1970s when you could ask your shoeshine boy and he'd talk about gold, right? Silver. I was the shoeshine boy. Okay. I wasn't the experienced veteran at the time, but I remember that. And it's nothing like that yet today. Normal people are starting to even begin to notice it. But, you know, the bartender's not bragging about how many ounces of gold he owns in, you know, at the local pub, that sort of thing, which happened back in the 70s. So what I'm saying is, you know, a market usually, you know, a cyclical market usually has a blow off top, you know, goes into a manic phase. And the CPI adjusted all-time high for gold doesn't by itself qualify for that. So I'm bullish for multiple reasons, but mostly I'm just a fundamentalist. And all the reasons that drove gold to 3,500, they're all still there. And I think they're all pushing it higher, Andy.
Yeah, no, that's a really good answer. And actually, like you, because of the price, I don't want to say I'm uncomfortable, but I'm suspicious, but I'm less suspicious just because of the fundamentals lining up. Also, anecdotally, I have luncheons with a group of investors here in Atlanta several times a week and dinners and that sort of thing. And some gold companies will come and present to us. And it's really the luncheons and the dinners are getting fuller. And that could be a sign of a top, of course, but it could also be a sign of a really healthy bull market and people are starting to catch on. And I think it's the latter, if you would.
An interesting sideways anecdote here. I just did something with Jay Martin from the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. He's called Commodities University, and he's got different experts doing different segments. It is for pay, got to say. But I did the segment on geology for non-geologists, you know, for investors. And we talked about it. And his reason for doing this is like, he's got, you know, one of these big shows, one of the biggest ones in our space. And he's noticing a bunch of new people coming in, younger people. And, you know, people who made money on crypto or whatever, and now they've got the bug. They want to invest and speculate on other things. And they're not Bitcoin maxis. They're agnostic. They're looking for any opportunity that looks reasonable. And so he's looking at these young people coming in, and they know nothing about the mining, and they know nothing about, you know, the promoters from Pender and Howe or on Bay Street. And he's thinking, you know, they're going to get they're going to get taken to the cleaners. Somebody's got to tell them what's what. And the point of the story isn't to talk about Jay Martin so much, but that's evidence of this new interest. Mm-hmm. But it's just beginning. It's. When you hear people all around you talking about gold or silver at the Thanksgiving table, the way they talk about cryptos in recent years, that's when I'll start getting nervous about the market being in the mania phase.
Yeah, good answer. I want to go back 6 months ago, and I want to give you a lot of props and a lot of kudos. And again, I mentioned this up to Cameron. I don't know if this was you were just lucky or good. And sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, I guess. That's the old.
Yeah, that's a famous Doug Casey saying, but go ahead and finish the question.
I just want to make a statement. Is your investment class, for lack of a better way to put it, was copper, and copper hit all-time highs. So congratulations to you. And again, we get some right, and I say this with all humility, we get some right, we get some wrong, but you were right, and you've actually been right. This is the second time you've pulled an asset class out in the past 2 years with me that you were dead on about. So talk to me a little bit about copper. Are you still bullish on that, or what are your thoughts on copper?
Yeah, I have to decline the honors in this case.
Because
copper going up to an all-time high, nominally at least, didn't go for the reasons that I said so, and it's already pulled back. So I really can't take props for that. And I will say that
I'm going to give them to you anyways.
Well, the year before I said, gold was my top call. That might not seem very exciting. Gold bug likes gold, but I'm not always, gold isn't always my top call. So that worked out well in 24. The year before that was uranium. And 23 was the year that uranium went screaming up to $100 a pound. My reasons for being bullish on copper are primarily all paths forwards are inflationary, great big beautiful bill working its way through Congress right now, trillions and trillions of deficit spending. The money helicopter's never left the air, and it's a critical mineral. So it's not an AI bet or an EV bet. Those are tailwinds that just add to this whole thing. And unlike many other important metals, copper's facing a severe structural supply deficit constraint for decades, really going forward. The pipeline isn't there. So I also like uranium, and I know you're going to ask about that, but there's a lot of uranium out there. And okay, it takes time to build mines and so on, but that's a more solvable problem in my view. Whereas these giant copper mines that can be, they're very, very rare. They take a long time to get permit. They disappear entire mountains or mountain ranges. It's hard to get these things going. And even Trump's incentives, he could incentivize the heck out of copper, and that wouldn't produce one more pound tomorrow. Even the shovel-ready projects in the U.S. will take time to come. So I'm very bullish on it. But it is Dr. Copper, right? It is that PhD in economics, right? It's so economically sensitive that if you're looking at the world and the global economy is already sluggish, and the U.S. economy still has yet to really see the impact of Trump's tariff war, and this isn't necessarily a criticism of Trump. I'm leaving the politics aside. Even if you agree with Trump completely on what he's trying to do, there's still going to be a cost to be paid. If you're going to retool the U.S. economy, that cannot be a painless transition. And you would expect that pain to show up in Dr. Copper and his prognosis. So I completely did not see copper going to an all-time high earlier this year. I think it did so for the wrong reasons. There was excitement, there was Trump shock, and so on. But we, in fact, don't have any action actually yet that justifies that. And I'm not surprised that it's pulled back. So I'm more pleased with my uranium call because I almost bottom ticked it again this year in that recent carve out of the bottom that we got. That might be the closest I've come in my career to bottom ticking a market. But this copper one, I got to say, you know, the bad news is I didn't see what was going to happen earlier this year happening. I would have thought the opposite, frankly. But the good news is all the reasons why I'm bullish on copper are still in front of us. And if we're going into that from, you know, 475 or close to $5 instead of under four or around four when I made that call, that portends much higher copper prices again, which should be really, really good for shareholders of companies that actually have the goods. I just talked about how difficult it is to find these things and permit them. If you've got a company that actually has the goods, even if they're still in the ground, right, you know, not, but an economically viable development project or discovery of economic tenor or a miner that's profitable and has growth on tap, I think these kinds of stocks will do really, really well. The only question I have is on the timing. And I came as close as in my career as the bottom ticking market. I think I got lucky there too. I did not know that would be the bottom. I just made my call on fundamental reasons and the technical starting to align. And this one, I think I did get lucky. Well, long story short, I think the upside is still ahead of us. What happened earlier this year is just a warm up, a pre-taste. If anything, it's like the overture with all that disharmonic noise as all the different musicians are tuning their instruments before the curtain goes up. So I'm very bullish. I do think we're likely to get another buying opportunity before the curtain goes up. And I am very deliberately accumulating cash to deploy heavily in that. And if we don't get the buying opportunity, I'll have to deploy at higher prices, yes. But my thesis is a multi-decade bull market. At that point, I won't care. If we're off to the races in that bull market, okay, I missed the bottom. You know, shoot me. I'm still going to make a bunch of money, and so will my readers.
Yeah. Well, speaking of somebody who is deflecting a lot of praise from timing and being self-deprecating on timing, you had another great call. And it was on when you were talking with me, we were talking about uranium, because at the time, uranium was just absolutely getting slaughtered for no apparent reason. Perhaps there is a big fund in trouble or whatever. And that usually when you have these kind of moves, that's usually the case. I don't know if that was the case, but that can be a case if you would. And I don't remember, I think it was on camera, but also via email. I love uranium here. Yeah, I did. How do I? We started gobbling up. I did too. I started gobbling up uranium, and that was the bottom. And again, I'm saying this with all due humility because I've been wrong many, many times. But you also mentioned, though, you would be highly accumulating uranium. And this was, I don't know, I want to say 18 months ago. At below $70. We're right around $70 on the spot price. What do you see? Are you still?
Sorry, no, you're out of date. We're up over 78.
Well, I apologize.
The recent spot action really, really lit a fire under the spot market.
Yes, I apologize.
We go back to that spot market joke, right?
Yeah, I apologize. That was a week or two ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there was a real vertical leap when that news came out of Sprott raising $200 million to buy uranium, which tells you something about how thinly traded the spot market is, that it can have such an outlandish impact from, you know, what on a global scale isn't really that much money.
Yeah.
And sorry, but since we're on this riff, you know, this is another reminder that the real market is the long-term contract price.
Yes.
Right. And the spot market is, you know, it gets overbought, gets oversold. My metaphor is it's like it's related to the long-term contract prices, but it's attached by rubber bands and it goes zinging up and down above and below. It's very noisy, but it can only do that for so long, and it can only go so far because then it opens arbitrage opportunities. If it's too out of whack one way or the other, there are arbitrage opportunities. So it does come back. And this is why, okay, you know, my call farther in the past is fine, but the one that I'm really lucky on now, if you will, lucky, I made a fundamental call on this basis, right? The long-term contract price never even rolled over. Okay, it went up in the 70s and it kind of stayed there for a while. We'll see what happens next, but it never went down. And so when spot corrected from 106 down to the low 60s, that was way overdone. History tells us that cannot go on forever. So that's me as a fundamentalist. And then I'm looking and I'm watching the market and it's, you know, clearly carving out a bottom. And like other, unlike other fluctuations, it's not just a sharp spike down and then up again. And then, you know, that might be volatility on the way down. It's carving out, like it's an endurable, you know, curving and then, you know, and then curving back up again without those spikes down. So with my fundamental view and then looking at that on the charts and thinking, okay, this has gone on too long, this, you know, this carving action. So I think this is time. So in not this last one, but the previous 2 months ago, the independent speculator, I put out a shopping list of a half a dozen stocks, all uranium stocks. And like I said, that is the closest I've come to bottom ticking a market, because, you know, that was pretty close. And, you know, and I mentioned the same idea as a general in my free macro letter. Then I said, I'm looking to buy uranium. You know, the good news is that all my reasons for that, you know, it's kind of like gold. All my reasons for that, they're still there. The demand story, it's almost a daily flow of news, a major news, you know, the World Bank pulling its ban on uranium investing, and the, you know, the Chinese want to double their reactor fleet. Okay, it's China, they're doubling, but they want to double their reactor fleet by 2040 on the scale of building nuclear power plants. That's tomorrow. This is huge. Right. And by the way, you buy your uranium in advance. And yes, the Chinese are also have a thorium reactor. They're experimenting. I know people are excited about thorium, but it's still experimental. This is all these new reactors are building. There's no mention of thorium there. Someday, maybe thorium becomes a preferred fuel for fission. But that day is not something that I worry about now. It's not relevant to my investment thesis. Neither is fusion. And neither is clean, beautiful coal or anything else. You know, we're going to need all this energy, including nuclear power plants. So I'm just really excited on this on a fundamental level. You know, the supply is constrained. The low-hanging fruit of the mines that people are building now in response to the high prices, almost all of them are delayed, over budget, some of them not happening at all. Or in some cases, like the world's largest and lowest cost producer, they moved the goalposts. They officially lowered their targets so they can say they're meeting them now, right? So all of this is just fantastic news. The fly in the ointment here is that it's so obvious. This thesis is so obvious. You know, even the Greens, even Germany, right, doing a U-turn on nuclear power. It's so the writing on the wall is so clear. It's like Life of Brian writing in large letters all over the entire Roman fortress, Romani go home, right? That everybody sees it. And so the better uranium stocks, at least, have gone from like literally 52-week lows to 52-week highs or even all-time highs in the last couple of months. Yeah. So the bad news is, or the, like I said, the fly in the ointment is, you know, I wouldn't chase these things right now. It's a highly volatile market. Remember that spot price, rubber bands. Okay, spot has everybody all excited now. There's always another fluctuation. I think this is maybe not a multi-decade bull like copper, because who knows, thorium or whatever. But there are years to make money in this market. There's no reason to be chasing anything that's at a 52-week high right now. You know, the idea is to buy low, sell high. I'm mm-hmm. not a subscriber to the greater fool theory of buy high and hope to heck to sell higher.
Well, on that note, yeah. And again, this was not intentional, but it seems like I'm heaping a lot of praise on you. But when we first met over Zoom, then we met at the Rural Symposium, which I'll see you again here pretty soon in the next few weeks. But you gave me some great advice in evaluating companies, and I want to work that out. If you're using this, your own advice, if you're doing this now, and it had to do with the Lassonde curve. And I want to say, please, please correct me if I'm wrong. 6 months out from production, roughly, that's when you get the safest and a strong upward move into the stock, if you would. And
yeah, I'm gonna have to correct you, Andy.
please.
The thesis is sound. This is my claim to fame in the industry. It's as far as I know, I'm the first one to actually quantify the pre-production sweet spot that set
yes.
and ramp up in the Lassonde curve. And the beauty of it is, it's like, okay, the 10 baggers lurk at the first part of the Lassonde curve, that discovery, right? Problem is, yeah. Nobody knows who's going to make a discovery. Not Rick Rule, not Doug Casey, certainly not me, right? It just, that's why these guys, they own hundreds of stocks. They have the wherewithal to have a very wide net and fish for these 100 baggers. Most retail people can't, you know, operate on that level. So the first part of the Lassonde curve is just, it's higher reward perhaps, but much higher risk. The second part The beauty of this thing is like, you know, if you don't start building a mine unless you're an idiot, unless you have the money, right? You have all the permits, you have everything ready to go, right? And feasibility study, and you have a pretty good idea that's going to work. So something like 95% of the companies that start building their mines actually get there. Mm-hmm. And again, the real beauty of the pre-production sweet spot is that the market recognizes this change of going from literally pouring money down holes in the ground, drilling, to getting money out of a big hole in the ground, the mine. That's worth a revaluation. And the beauty of this is like the market revalues the company as they're building the mine, this time period you talked about. And as you get to first pour or first plate, if it's copper or first production of whatever it is, there's a revaluation. And it's on average on the order of a double. So, okay, it's not a 10 bagger, but the success rate is much higher. So this is what I love. It's very rare to be able to speculate with a high probability of success and for gains that matter. But the beauty of it is you don't actually know if the mine's going to work. Like, you know, if the feasibility study was bad or the metallurgy was wrong or you get underground and, you know, there's bad ground that you didn't expect or something, that you find that out after you go into production. But the re-rate, the market re-rate has already happened. So I love this. And it's my hands down favorite investment strategy. The only problem is that there are not many of these per year. You know, so I, and of course, you know, I do want the 10 baggers too. So I have more than just pre-production sweet spot plays. The correction is that the average length of time is about 2 years, actually, the overall from a construction decision to the first pour. Now, from that construction decision, it's kind of boring at first. You know, you're still just getting going. You know, maybe you're doing some civil engineering, but it's in the last, it's known even before I got into this. You know, it's been known like in the last 9 months, they call it the pregnancy stage. I don't know if that's politically correct or not, but the last 9 months before first pour, before you get that nice baby bar of gold so warm out of the oven, right? That's when you start seeing more of these gains. And it makes sense because a lot of this is just, you know, market excitement, the market looking at these shiny new yellow trucks and, you know, here's the plants going up, here's the portal, you know, here's our vein up close and personal underground, right? All this stuff, you see it in the pictures, Mr. Market starts getting excited. And we've actually found that, yeah, it's that time period is variable, but it's in like the last third to a quarter of whatever that construction time is when, you know, the pictures are really coming fast and furious. Yeah, it's got a gold mine, right? You know, or copper or whatever, you know, it's happening. You can see it happening. That's when investors really start piling in more. You can make more, you can maximize your gains if you get in early, but if you jump on that bandwagon while it's happening, you can still usually do well. I'm sorry to say, I do have one caveat here, Andy, in that after I published this research and we've expanded on it and it's known, it's out there, we're seeing evidence that other people are doing this, right? You know, I let the cat out of the bag, as it were. And we're seeing evidence that in some cases, people are front-running the pre-production sweet spot. When something is obviously a high-margin mine in the making, pre-production sweet spot. And so they'll pile in early on. And you start to get some of that reward earlier, and then like nothing happens as you get closer to that first pour. So for me, the sweet spot, the really sweet spot, has become identifying the companies before they officially enter that pre-production sweet spot that I'm, you know, have high confidence will, because many don't, right? The feasibility study, everybody's all excited, all these high grade drill results. And then it turns out the average of the whole deposit is much lower than those headlines, right? And the feasibility study comes up with an internal rate of return that's just, you know, right? So there's a lot of things that can go wrong between, you know, exciting discovery in that boring engineering phase before the pre-production sweet spot. And with my experience in the field, I think I'm pretty good at telling which rocks really have a chance of becoming a mine.
So that's a great answer. And I don't know where I got 6 months. I was going to say 6 to 12 months, but I've been using that in the past. But
it might have been your experience. There could have been, like I said, it's that last one third to a quarter of the PPSS where you see the biggest gains, you know, historically. So you might have had one where that was 6 months.
Yeah, or 12 months, but I try to use that as a window. And it's funny you say that, because maybe the gentleman that I have dinner and luncheons with, there's probably 100 of us, and the 40 of them will show up at a time, and a gold mine will come and present and that sort of thing. And I think we're all stealing from you, because maybe we're front running, because now one of the questions that are always being asked, when are you going to production? When are you going to production? And you can see guys literally on their phones about to game it.
Well, when this first came up, you know, I didn't do the original research. I have a very bright fellow who works for me again now, at the time, who went out and gathered the data for me. But it was my idea. I was working for Dud Casey for the International Speculator, and I was thinking of, you know, something to write about. I was keen on gold, or, you know, thinking about what to write about. And so I asked Doug, you know, what about this? What about the second part of the Lassonde curve? Everybody loves the 10 baggers and the discovery and all that stuff. But what about that other part? It goes up. You know, how much is that? What are the gains? And Doug's like, oh, you know, everybody can see who's building a mine. It can't be much. It'll be priced in, right? So, you know, maybe 10 or 20%, not worth the wait, you know, compared to, you know, what we normally want. So I had this very bright young fellow. His name is Constantine, by the way. Give credit where due. And he went out and he came up, you know, a couple dozen examples. And the average was like 145% or something like that from construction decision to first pour. And I said, no, that can't be right. So I sent him back and he like doubled the sample size. And okay, it came down to 115 or something. It was still more than a double. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, holy cow, that this is real. I mean, that's enough cases. If there's only a couple of these per year in our database now, you know, I've rebuilt and expanded on this database we do every year. And we've got something like 120 examples of pre-production sweet spot companies. And it's not everybody who builds a mine, because if you've already got one and you build another one, you're not making that transition from blowing money to making money, right? So it has to be a first-time mine builder. And there's just not many of those, right? So 120 of them, I think we actually have, that's not just a representative sample. I think that's most of the cases for the last 30 years or so. So it's not a very large number, but since it's not a sample, you know, representative, like it's most of the actual cases. They're very robust findings. So this is, you know, like I say, it's hands down my favorite strategy when I can find a great pre-production sweet spot play. But they're rare enough. And then sometimes there's political risk. Like if it's, I don't know, Burkina Faso, where they have two coups a year or something like that. Or Mali, right, which just nationalized a mine. You know, I'm not going there, right? Somebody else can do that one. I'm not going there. So the ones that, to me, due diligence still matters on these. The ones that make the grade for me, it's not enough. I need more, but it is my favorite.
Yeah. Well, you had a big impact on me when we discussed that. So thank you for that. And I think it touched a lot of other gentlemen investors here in Atlanta more than you know. Real quick, I'm a big fan of your work, and you don't know this, but Rick and Doug, as well as you, have been mentors of mine from afar. If people want to be mentored by you or want to learn more about you and use your services, how do they do that?
Well, that's interesting that you frame it in terms of mentoring. And I do have a free weekly letter. It's my macro. If you want to know what stocks I'm buying, that's what people pay me for, right? In the Independent Speculator. But the Speculator's Digest is free. And I do think of it as educational. And I share my thoughts and so on in my articles and things. But there's also a Q&A section. Every week there's some questions and answer, and I'll answer. You know, I can't give anybody individual investment advice, of course, but I can talk about markets. And I do think that's educational. And there are also, not to go on at length about this, but since you frame it this way, there are educational materials on the website. If you look at the free reports, there are how-tos, Speculation 101, that sort of thing. And we don't have a section for it, but every once in a while I write a cheat sheet. So there's a cheat sheet on processing or interpreting drill results or feasibility studies or something like
great.
That.
Great. You did one on grade, if I'm not mistaken. Right.
So if you use a little magnifying glass search tool on our website and type cheat sheet in there, you'll find some of those educational materials.
Yeah. And at the independentspeculator.com. Yeah. I will put all of this in the show notes, both on the YouTube channel, the Apple and Spotify channels. Lobo, I want to thank you so much. Off camera, you're very gracious to me and you always make the time for me. So I want to thank you for that. And I'm really looking forward to spending some time with you at Rural Symposium in Boca in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Andy. I'm looking forward to it as well.
All right. Take care.